Chapter 15. Sea Glass, 1980. The face of my 9-year-old sister fills the screen. It appears to be Lily's turn to be the star of the family home movie. Some people are born to be the stars of their own show, and she was never interested in learning life's lines unless they were from her own script. Other people are viewed as little more than extras in Lily's rather narrow field of vision. If you don't have a scene in her story, you don't exist in her world. Our summers at Sea Glass were always my favourite time of year as a young child. As soon as school was over for my sisters, my mother would load up the car with suitcases, food, wine, and us, and then we'd make the journey from London to Cornwall and escape the city for 6 weeks. Inevitably, we would always time it wrong, arriving when the tide was in so we couldn't cross the causeway, but that didn't matter. As soon as I could see the old house with its turquoise turrets, it always felt like I was home. We would play on the thin strip of remaining black sand while we waited for the sea to retreat. Sometimes, having to wait for something just makes you want it more. Nana was always so happy to see us. She would cross the sandy causeway as soon as it was safe to do so, always with the rusty old wheelbarrow in front of her and a dog close behind. I remember a black Labrador called Bob before Poppins came along. Nana would hug and kiss us all, then load our bags onto the wheelbarrow to make it easier to transport everything to the house. It took a few trips back and forth, and we'd take it in turns to ride on top. Our bedrooms were always as we'd left them, but with clean sheets, fresh flowers, and a chocolate coin beneath the pillow of each bed. Nana always knew how to make us feel welcome and loved when we were children. Dad was rarely there, even before the divorce. My father would normally join us for at least a couple of weeks, but I don't remember him being there at all during the summer of 1980, until after it happened. Which makes me wonder if my parents' marriage was already in trouble, way back then. It was also around that time that our mother insisted we call her Nancy. She said that to keep calling her anything else made her feel old. The room is completely quiet as the video begins. 9-year-old Lily is standing in the hallway full of clocks at Sea Glass. There are still spaces on the wall for the extra 20 or so clocks Nana has collected since. I remember this as Lily's fame phase. I think we all do. And Nancy smiles in the present when her favourite daughter smiles in the past. Lily takes a few steps back from the camera to reveal a 1980s outfit that these days would be mistaken for fancy dress. The neon pink t-shirt, purple leggings, tutu, headband and pink leg warmers bring it all back. I notice the others smiling as the child on the screen dances to the music and sings along, knowing every word of the fame theme tune. Her endless singing about living forever seems to bother me the most, along with the other lyric she repeats a few seconds later, staring straight at the camera. Remember, 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 remember. I do remember that summer at Sea Glass. I wish that I didn't. If you were to walk into Nana's house, there are 3 doors on the left of the hallway, 2 at the end and 1 on the right. On the left, you'd find a lounge, then a small library, then the music room. At the far end of the clock-filled hall is a door to the enormous kitchen and a door to a tiny bathroom. An elaborate staircase is on the right of the hallway, but just before that, there is one other door, which was almost always locked. Nana's studio, or the West Wing, as she sometimes liked to call it, was very much out of bounds when my sisters came to stay. It runs the full length of the house, with a door at each end, and is where she liked to write and illustrate her children's books. These days, there are giant framed book covers on the walls, including Daisy Darker's Little Secret and some of Nana's other favourites. Susie Smith's Best Birthday, Danny Delaney's Lost Dog, Poppy Patel's First Fib, and Charlie Cho's Worst Weekend. but back in 1980, Nana was still illustrating other people's books and had yet to write one of her own. Inside the studio, there were three large desks permanently covered in sketchbooks and drawings, four windows letting in lots of light, endless rows of different watercolour paints, pots full of ink, pens, pencils and brushes, and enormous drawers filled with different coloured paper. There were shelves crammed full of all sorts of paraphernalia that Nana once described as a few of my favourite things. And there was a huge easel with a white sheet over the top on the day this home movie was filmed. The sheet was hiding Nana's latest work in progress. She didn't like anyone to see her work until it was finished. A newspaper once described Nana as the female Quentin Blake. She was furious and said that they should have called him the male Beatrice Darker. Nana's studio was the only room in Seaglass where my sisters were not allowed to look at anything, touch anything, or even venture inside. I was allowed, when it was just Nana and I. And so was Connor. But she never trusted my sisters, even back then. They both knew and understood the rules, but Lily was never very good at following them. When she got a pair of roller skates for her 9th birthday, all she wanted to do was skate around the house. With all the internal doors open, it was possible to skate from the hall to the lounge, through to the library, then the music room, the kitchen, and Nana's studio in a giant loop. And there was nothing Rose or I could say to persuade her that this was a very bad idea. As soon as Nana had left that morning to cycle into town for supplies, Lily put on her skates. She insisted that Rose time her skating laps and film her doing them. It was my job to watch the causeway from my bedroom window upstairs and warn my sisters when Nana returned, which I fully intended to do. But the sky was extremely blue that day, and the clouds drifting across it made very interesting shapes. I spotted a cloud pony and a cloud castle, both of which were distracting for a 4-year-old with a big imagination. I'd been taught to name a few clouds by Rose, the walking, talking encyclopedia of the family. There is nothing more calming than a good fluffy white cumulus in a bright blue sky, or the bird-like beauty of cirrus clouds made from tiny ice crystals, or a sky full of thick stratocumulus, because in real life, we all contain shades of light and dark. There are as many different kinds of clouds as there are different kinds of people. And, like people, they all float and drift as they please, being one thing one minute, transforming into something quite different the next, unrecognizable in the blink of an eye. The circle of life exists in every aspect of nature, and we all just play our part for as long as the universe decides. The home movie begins with Rose, filming from the hallway as Lily shoots past, skating through every room and singing along to the Fame theme tune at the same time. "Is this my best side?" Lily asked, whooshing by. "They're both as bad as each other," 10-year-old Rose replied from behind the camera, and I imagine her smiling to herself. The video is surprisingly good. Then, the star of the show got a little more ambitious and decided to film herself while skating and singing. Sometimes she aimed the camera down at her feet and I could see the red and white roller skates I remember so well zooming across the wooden floors. It took her forever to lace up those skates, and Lily was almost as tall as Rose when wearing them. Perhaps that was another reason why she loved them. The music was so loud that neither of my sisters heard Nana return. The home movie shows Lily's point of view as she is filming and skating into one end of the studio. The camera work wobbles when she spots Nana standing at the other end of the room with her arms and face folded into cross shapes. Then Lily collides with an enormous easel, sending a giant painting crashing to the floor. The film ends on a sideways, ground-level shot, showing puddles of red and blue paint. Nana marched over and peered down at my sister where she had fallen. Lily Darker, you have a lot to learn. If you must always break the rules in life, you need to understand how to do so without getting caught. Look like the innocent flower, but be the serpent under it.
What?
Lily said, rubbing a bruised knee. Pardon, not what? It's Shakespeare. Nana may as well have said it was Swahili. Look, Lily, I admire your spirit and your ambition to always get your own way in life, but I fear others might find your personality tiresome and petulant when you are older. If you want to be bad and get away with it, you need to be better at pretending to be good, like the innocent flower they all wish you were. Understand? Upstairs, I had just spotted a cloud dragon in the sky outside my bedroom window, and when Lily appeared in the doorway, red-faced and with flaring nostrils, she looked a lot like a dragon and nothing like an innocent flower.
You were supposed to be on lookout, she hissed. Why must you be such a baby? And when are you going to grow up?
I reached inside myself for a suitable response, but despite a frantic search, could not find one until the moment had passed and she was no longer there to hear it. There are a lot of things I wish I'd said to my older siblings when I was a child, if only I had been clever enough to think of them at the time. But I just said sorry, like always. Apologies were a bit like get-out-of-jail-free cards in our house. Lily was banned from roller skating inside or outside Seaglass for a week, and I got the blame. She didn't speak to me at all for 3 days, which was a blessing in some ways. But then Lily did something I have never known her to do before or since. She apologized.
I'm sorry I shouted at you, Daisy, she said, wearing another one of her neon-coloured 1980s costumes. It wasn't fair of me to blame you for what happened, and I've got you a little surprise to make up for it. It's in the cupboard under the stairs.
I don't believe you, I said, because I didn't. Lily was always telling fibs, and we were all a bit scared of the cupboard under the stairs. The reason why someone is lying is almost always more interesting than the lie itself.
Don't then, she replied with a custom shrug of her shoulders. Rose, isn't there a surprise for Daisy downstairs?
Nana was out walking the dog and had left Rose in charge because our mother was taking a nap. Rose was passing my bedroom with her nose in an Encyclopedia Britannica that looked heavier than me, and she was clearly only half listening. Rose knew that she wanted to be a vet from a very young age, just like Lily knew that she didn't want to be or do anything. Neither of them changed their minds over the years. It was different for me. My dreams changed shape as often as the clouds I liked staring at. One year, I wanted to be a musician, like my father. Another, I dreamt of writing books, like Nana. But I never thought I'd live long enough to do either. Which might be why I stopped aiming for a life that felt too out of reach. Rose was often left in charge because she was the oldest. It was a responsibility that she, like a lot of eldest siblings, came to resent.
Oh yes, the surprise, she said. We all know about it, the one downstairs.
Looking back now, I don't think she knew what was going on. But I trusted Rose. So I went down the creaky steps sideways and one at a time. They were steep, and my little legs were still rather short, completely oblivious to the fact that Lily was filming the whole thing.
That's right. Step inside the cupboard, she said. There's a secret fairy door in the wall, right at the back there. Do you see it? You'll have to go all the way in to find it.
The idea of a secret fairy door in the skirting board was very exciting to 4-year-old me. I soon overcame my fear and went inside.
Knock on the wood, said Lily. The fairies might come out and say hello. I did as she said. But what appeared wasn't a fairy. The tiny door shape in the skirting board was in fact a mouse hole. But the mouse that ran out looked enormous, more like a rat. As soon as I screamed, Lily closed the cupboard door, locking me inside.
Chapter 16. Seaglass, 1980.
I cried in the dark for what felt like hours, and I banged on that door until my knuckles bled. I was never afraid of the dark before then, but I have been ever since. I don't think that's childish or silly. I think it's completely logical to fear what you cannot see. Our mother was sleeping off a vat of cheap wine she'd drunk alone at lunchtime, while I was locked inside the cupboard under the stairs. She'd taken a pill and put in earplugs to drown out the sound of her children. So it was only when Nana came back from walking the dog that anyone heard me crying. Her face was one of horror when she finally found the keys and unlocked the cupboard door. Lily was banned from roller skating for 2 more weeks, and it was Nana's idea that Rose and Lily should be further punished by having to take me to the beach on my 5th birthday. The following week, after a breakfast of pancakes with hot chocolate sauce, that's what they begrudgingly did, both holding one of my hands so that I could swing between them. "And do not take your father's camcorder. I've told you before, it's not a toy. If you get sand in it and it stops working, I'll never hear the end of it," said Nancy, waving us off at the door.
"Okay,"
yelled Lily, already marching down the causeway with the camcorder tucked inside her backpack. She held my hand as we headed for the beach until she thought Nana and our mother could no longer see. I remember her grinning in my direction. Her smile had holes where the tooth fairy had stolen her teeth, a bit like the piano with its missing key.
"You're 5 now, Daisy, and I think you're old enough to play with Rose and me more often," Lily said.
Rose frowned as though hearing this for the first time.
"Would you like that?"
I nodded. I would have done almost anything to get them to like me more. The age gap between them at 9 and 10 was minimal, but the years between them and me always seemed vast. I would often watch them playing clapping games, tapping their hands together faster and faster while chanting strange rhymes. There was one about going to a Chinese restaurant to buy a loaf of bread. It made no sense to me, but I longed to be a part of it anyway. I had tried several times before to keep up with their big girl games, and it rarely ended well. I was permanently covered in scratches and bruises, and my nostrils were frequently overcome by the smell of Savlon and TCP. We played with an old skipping rope until Lily got bored, chanting the rhymes their friends had taught them and they had taught me. I didn't know what half of them meant, but I learned the words through repetition and a desire to join in, just like all children do. I remember my favourite rhyme we used to chant and skip to. "Lizzie Borden took an axe. She gave her mother 40 whacks. After she saw what she had done, she gave her father 41. Lizzie Borden got away. For her crime, she did not pay." Rose loved that rhyme. Those skipping games on the beach were one of the few childhood activities at Seaglass that required all 3 of us. 2 to swing the rope, 1 to jump.
"Let's play the mermaid game instead. Do you want to go first?" Lily said, with her hole-filled smile.
They buried me in the black sand until my face was all they could see. Then they made a sand-shaped mermaid's tail and decorated it with seashells. They left me there for over an hour while they built sandcastles nearby. Our family seems like a sandcastle to me now, quick and relatively effortless to build, and even faster to wash away, as though it never existed. I can remember nothing solid about the relationships we had with one another. Nothing substantial that couldn't be obliterated in a mere moment by a crossword or the crash of a wave none of us saw coming. I remember hating both of my sisters for the first time that day. Really hating them. I couldn't move. The sand was too heavy where they had buried me beneath it. My face was burning in the hot sun and I was crying. Until Connor came along. He had two yo-yos that year and could do all kinds of clever tricks with them, both at once. I heard him talking to Rose before I saw him. "Did you know that sea glass was one of the properties used in the Second World War to look after evacuated children?" he said. "No? How do you know that?" 10-year-old Rose asked, sounding genuinely interested. "I read about it at the library, and now I'm writing about it for my school newspaper. I'm going to be a journalist one day. Children would walk here to this stretch of coast, all the way from Plymouth. A long line of them carrying their little suitcases over the hills and sand dunes to escape the bombings in the city, leaving their parents behind."
"Connor, help me!" I yelled.
He looked amused at first when he spotted me stuck in the sand with my mermaid's tail of shells. But when he saw that I'd been crying, he dug me out at once and pulled me up. "It was just a joke," said Rose, looking at Connor, not wanting him to think badly of her.
"Yeah, don't be such a crybaby all the time," said Lily. "I hate you both," I said, then stormed off to get my armbands. "I'm going to swim to America, and I never want to see either of you ever again."
When Lily laughed, it only made me more determined. The tide was coming in, and I think, deep down, I knew I'd probably only make it to the little rock island half a mile out, but I thought I was a good swimmer. And with my orange armbands, I felt invincible. I looked at Rose, who was the eldest after all, but she just stared down at the sand. That was when Lily picked up the camcorder again. I watch now in horror, along with the rest of the family in the present, as 5-year-old me starts to swim out to sea. It reminds me of when we watched Titanic together, knowing that the film couldn't possibly end well. I see myself getting smaller and smaller, doing my own variation of doggy paddle, where sometimes I threw in a lopsided breaststroke because I didn't know any better. Only Lily and Rose had been sent for swimming lessons. When I was halfway to the rock island, I got scared and turned around. Rose was at the water's edge, yelling something I could not hear. Connor was waving his arms, and even Lily appeared to be a little worried, beckoning me to come back. They all looked very small and far away, and I decided maybe it wasn't a good idea to swim to America that day after all. I tried to head back towards Black Sand Bay, but the sea had other plans. I was dragged sideways first, then backwards. Then one of my armbands came off when a wave crashed over me. We'd been warned about the dangerous undercurrents in the bay when the tide was this distance from the shoreline, but I was too little to understand the consequences of ignoring them. Fear is something we have to feel to learn, and learn to feel. The harder I tried to swim towards my sisters, the further away they seemed to get. The ocean was suddenly very loud inside my little ears. It dragged me under. I remember the panic and the pain. I felt as though the cold water had stolen the air from my lungs and I couldn't breathe. Then the sea and sky folded in on each other and on me. I was drowning in blue. Then life turned black. Rose pulled off her clothes, dumped them on the sand, and ran into the ocean wearing a red swimsuit. She was only 10. And she knowingly risked her own life to save mine that day. Things were different after that. Once Rose knew I was broken, I became something she wanted to fix. an injured bird in her imaginary cage. She dragged me back to shore, then performed the CPR that cracked two of my ribs. And Lily filmed the whole thing. It feels like an out-of-body experience as I watch myself coughing up water and see Nana and my mother running onto the beach. The film stops then, but I remember the paramedics doing their best to cross the causeway, and I remember seeing Connor and Rose holding hands as I was carried away from them all. He wrote a story about her for his school newspaper after that. The headline read, "Local Hero Saves Her Sister's Life." It was the first time that I understood that friendships can change a person. True best friends bring out the best in you. I was in hospital for 2 weeks while the doctors prodded and poked me. Routine tests revealed my broken heart, and things were never the same again. The first night, when my family had all left and I was alone on a scary ward, I was grateful that my bed was next to the window. The moon was bright that evening, and it meant that I could see cloud creatures, even though the sky was black. They danced across the shy moon, but the shapes they made no longer resembled ponies or dragons. Only monsters. Monsters don't always hide in the dark. Some walk around in broad daylight, happy to be seen by anyone foolish enough to look in their direction. My mother blamed herself for my broken heart. I have always known that deep down, but never quite understood why. Something she did while pregnant with me, perhaps? The doctors said my condition was so rare they still didn't know what caused it. Nancy spent days sitting by my bedside or in waiting rooms. She tutted and sighed and flicked through the free magazines, looking for competitions to enter. Nancy rarely read anything except a TV guide. I remember when the doctors said that I was well enough for the whole family to visit. My sisters gave me homemade get-well cards. Nana brought me a bottle of Lucozade and a box of Quality Street filled with only toffee pennies because they were my favourites. Dad sent all his love from a concert hall in Vienna. Apparently, there were no flights back to the UK that week. Lily wore a new dress and her very best smile for the occasion. She was the last one to leave my hospital bed and rushed back over when they were all about to go. Everyone waited in the entrance to the ward while she whispered something in my ear before kissing me on the cheek. "Good girl," said Nancy, happy that her favourite daughter was trying to make up for what had happened. She has always been a firm believer in fraudulent feelings. She presumed Lily had apologised and didn't hear what my sister had really said. None of them did, but I've never forgotten it.
"I wish you had drowned."
Chapter 17. 31st of October, 1:45 a.m. Less than 5 hours until low tide. I was never allowed to go to school once my hidden heart problem was exposed, and life was never allowed to return to normal, for any of us. My parents divorced less than a year later. Some marriages are held hostage by memories of happier times. Others are imprisoned by the idea that parenthood can only be performed well in pairs. A dying child seemed to set my parents free from each other. My two older sisters were sent to boarding school. I was more than enough for my mother to look after, and they were too much. A groundless guilt consumed her, and she wrapped the rest of my childhood in cotton wool, which, in turn, led to me wrapping myself inside books. Hundreds of them. Reading was one of the few things I was still allowed to do. Books saved me, and I ran away inside the stories I read as a child. They were the only place where I could run and swim and dance without fear of falling and not being able to get back up. Books were full of friends and adventures, whereas my real childhood was cold and dark and horribly lonely. I've never spoken honestly about it with anybody. Until now. And the only place that felt like home when I was a child was sea glass. I think that's why the idea of never coming back here hurts too much. Nana's little library was my Disneyland, and the books inside it were the paper-shaped rides that let me live, while everyone else was waiting for me to die. Sometimes people get impatient when they have to wait too long for something. I've always felt terrible about what happened that day on the beach, and all the other days when I wasn't as kind as I could have been, says Lily, back in the present, where she can no longer bully me the way she used to. She doesn't look me in the eye when she says it. I don't think she can. And I don't really believe that Lily is sorry at all. Her words do nothing to blunt my anger. Instead, they sharpen it into a more dangerous shape, one which will leave a mark. But I bite my tongue, as always, keen to keep the peace. My sisters won't talk to me because of what happened with Connor a few years ago. It seems so unfair, given all the things they did when I was a child. But saying how I really feel about it all now isn't going to help fix what got broken then. And there are bigger things to worry about. Why would someone want us to watch that home movie? I look at my sisters tonight and see us all exactly the same way we were then. They might be taller, older, have a few more wrinkles, but we are all just children masquerading as the adults we thought we should become. My personality is very similar now to what it was when I was a child. I'm still shy and quiet and happiest at home. Rose and Lily haven't changed very much either. None of us have. Not really. There are pockets of sadness in all of our lives, and mine are deep. The diagnosis of my broken heart felt like a death sentence, and 5 is awfully young to find out that you won't live forever. They say that your life flashes before your eyes when you die, so you should make it a life worth watching. But as someone who has died several times, I don't think that is true. For me, every time my heart stopped beating, it felt like a delayed train journey through the cruelest moments of my life. The memories didn't flash, they were slow and painful. It was like travelling through time and space to somewhere dark and cold, to relive my worst mistakes in technicolor misery. Sometimes I could still hear people around me when my heart stopped. I swear I heard doctors or nurses saying that I was dead on more than one occasion. My parents didn't believe me back then, but neurologists have since confirmed that the human brain is still active for a period of time after death, and I promise you that it is true. Dead people can hear you, so be careful what you say. I hope it wasn't too awful for Nana, or my dad. I hope neither of them heard something they shouldn't have. We take death almost as for granted as life. We think we know what to expect because we've read a chapter of a book or watched a scene in a film. We no longer seem capable of separating fiction from facts. There is so much that we don't know we don't know. It scares me. When you've died as often as I have, it's hard not to become a little preoccupied with it all. And seeing other people take their good health for granted makes me so angry. None of them understand what it's like for me. How could they? I'm grateful to still be here, but death has been part of my life for so long. I worry about it all of the time. Our future is just our past in the making.
I don't get it,
says Connor. Who left this tape on the kitchen table with the words "Watch me" stuck to the front? It must have been one of us, so who was it?
Nobody answers him.
Lily lights another cigarette before tossing the match in a log on the fire, which crackles and spits and choreographs 100 eerie shadows to dance across the room. Then she takes a long drag before slowly blowing smoke from her pink lips.
Do you ever think about anyone except yourself?
Rose says, staring at her.
What does that mean?
Lily asks, sitting up and staring back.
Rose, says Nancy, trying to prevent storm damage when the rest of us can see that the roof has already blown right off.
The home movie has brought back some unhappy memories for everyone. Maybe that's why someone thought we should watch it.
When Lily loses her temper, she's the only one who can find it again.
But it's unlike Rose to lose control of her emotions.
Honestly, you are the most selfish and spoilt person I've ever had the misfortune to know. I'd actually forgotten how cruel you used to be to Daisy when we were kids. The poem in the kitchen and everything Dad said about you last night is true.
Rose continues, while we all wait for Lily to react. I fully expect her next words to be soaked in sarcasm, her preferred form of self-defense. I confess I do enjoy it more than I should when my older sisters squabble. It always felt like them against me when we were younger, and them against one another is much more fun. All families have their own private routines and secret language, and all families know how to hurt each other.
I don't care what Dad thought about me, and I don't care what you think either. Why don't you get a life and stop judging mine?
Lily says,
I'd gladly not watch the car crash that is your life any longer. It's embarrassing. Maybe with Nana and Dad gone, we don't need to keep playing happy families. Perhaps we can all just go our separate ways for good when the tide goes out.
Rose, you don't mean that, says Nancy.
Don't I?
As soon as she sees the look on our mother's face, my eldest sister softens again, retreating inside the version of herself she thinks we all want her to be.
I'm sorry. I already had a terrible day before I got here, and like everyone else, I just can't believe what has happened. Or that Nana and Dad are gone.
Rose's unexpected Jekyll and Hyde routine catches us all off guard. When I try to translate the look on her face, I think it is fear. Rose is terrified. And maybe she is right to be. Maybe finally, and for the first time, my family does know what it is like to be me. To live with a constant fear that today might be their last. I see the same fear on the faces of the residents at the care home where I volunteer, because they know their time is almost up. I do my best to comfort them, listen to their regrets and ease their anxiety, but they know it's inevitable. Life kills us all in the end. I stare at my family as we sit in yet another awkward silence, wondering how it came to this. In contrast, the storm outside continues to make itself heard, the sound of rain constantly tapping on the windows like 1,000 tiny fingernails.
Why was yesterday a bad day?
Connor asks Rose, sounding genuinely interested. She makes eye contact with him very briefly, then stares into the distance as though reliving another memory she would rather forget.
I got a call from the RSPCA yesterday afternoon. I had to stop off at a disused barn on the way here, and there were 6 ponies locked inside. They hadn't had food or water for days.
Even Lily looks moved.
That's so sad. What did you do?
Will they get rehomed? I shot every one of them, between the eyes.
Rose looks up, but nobody says anything.
I look around the room and see that everyone is as shocked as I feel. I had to, she says. It was too late to save them,
There was nothing I could do. They were in agony. I had to do something to end their pain, but I didn't have enough anaesthetic to inject them all. My gun was the only option. It was awful. I can still hear them. Did you know that horses cry when they're scared? Like children. Her hands tremble a little, and she balls them into fists. I wish I could have shot those responsible instead. Sometimes I loathe people, I really do. I don't understand how human beings are capable of such horrific things, or why they inflict so much pain on others. The silence seems to swallow us all this time. I didn't even know you had a gun, says Lily. Rose sighs. It's just a small handgun. A lot of vets have guns and a license to use them. It's normally locked in the safe at the practice. Nancy frowns. But if you did that on the way here, does that mean there is a loaded gun in the house? With real bullets? Oh, don't worry, I hid it somewhere safe when I arrived. The silence resumes, and I study my eldest sister for a while. I know that her vet practice is having a little money trouble, but I also know she has always been too proud to ask for any financial help from anyone, unlike Lily. Rose would have really benefited from Nana's money had she been left any, and would have put it to good use. I notice how she keeps checking her watch, and wonder whether she is just counting down the hours before we can leave. Just over 4 now, I think. Rose looks so sad. She has always found human company unsatisfying. She says she finds it exhausting to listen to the manufactured feelings of people too stupid to know when their thoughts are not their own. I wonder what her thoughts are now, as she checks her watch again, for the second time in less than a minute. I'm not the only one studying Rose, and it's as though the weight of our stares are too heavy for her to bear. Why are you all looking at me like that? She asks. I think, given everything that has happened tonight, we all might feel a bit anxious about there being a gun in the house, says Nancy. Fine. My gun didn't kill anyone, but if it will make everyone feel better, I'll go and check that it's still safe where I left it, Rose says, standing to leave the room. Vets are more likely to commit suicide than almost any other profession. That statistic used to make me worry about my eldest sister. Vets work long hours, often alone. And when I think of all the horrific things she has seen, it scares me. Rose knows how to end lives as well as save them. Sadly, it's part of her job. I might see if I can get a signal on my phone upstairs. Maybe it will work up there, says Connor. It won't, says Lily. I don't feel quite right. I'm going to my room to try and find my diabetic kit. Nancy nods. I can feel one of my migraines coming. I'm going to get a glass of water and some pills from the kitchen, she says, heading for the door like the rest of them. My mother thinks there is a pill for any and all situations. Well, I might just get a bit of air, I say, not wanting to be left behind. I think we're all feeling a little claustrophobic, trapped in this house together, but also all scared of being alone. I stand in the hallway and can hear different corners of the house creaking with quiet activity. The noise does nothing to calm my nerves. I have always preferred the sound of silence. I notice that the front door is slightly ajar and step out onto the porch, but there is nobody there. The roar of the sea and the melody of the wind chimes remind me how isolated we are out here, cut off from the mainland for several hours every day and night. When you've spent as much time alone as I have, it can be hard to be around people for too long. Even family. Especially one like ours. I was the last to leave the room, but think I'm the first to return to the lounge a short while later, and I spot something unfamiliar on the coffee table. The rest of the family come back before I can take a closer look. Connor is the last to return, but he's the first to see what I saw, and from the tone of his voice, it's as though he's accusing me of putting it there.
"What's that on the table?"
he asks.
"It's the tape we just watched,"
Lily replies. "I don't think it is," I say, taking a step back. "No, it isn't," Rose confirms. We're all looking at the tape now. It wasn't there before, and the Scrabble letters stuck to the case of this home movie spell a different message. "Hear me."
"What the hell?" says Connor. "Who did this?"
He looks around the room at each of us.
"You're the one who noticed it. Maybe it was you," says Lily.
Rose picks it up carefully. "The last tape said, watch me. This one says, hear me.
This is super messed up. Who would do this? And why?"
We are all staring at one another, silent accusations exchanged in the form of wary glances. "We should watch it," I say. And then everyone starts arguing about the pros and cons of doing so.
"Enough," Nancy says.
And the rest of us are quiet.
"No more games. Nana and your dad are dead. There's nobody else here at Seaglass, and I don't believe in ghosts. Who left that tape on the table?"
Nobody answers. "Maybe the only way to find out is to watch it," Rose says. And when nobody argues, she slides the video out of its case and into the machine, then presses play. Chapter 18. Seaglass, 1982. Christmases at Seaglass were always magical, until my parents got divorced. Nana made a bigger effort than ever to welcome my mother, my sisters and me, but it didn't feel quite the same without Dad there. I'll never forget the Christmas of 1982. I was 7, Lily was 11, and Rose was 12. We had a huge tree that year, delivered by boat, which we all helped to decorate. We made paper chains and a wonky chocolate Yule log. Then on Christmas Eve, the Darker family women watched E.T. It was my first ever trip to the cinema, and I loved every minute of it. But the home movie I can see on Nana's old TV now didn't capture any of that. It starts on Christmas Day, 1982, and, as usual, begins with Lily. If Father Christmas really did make a naughty list every year, then my sister would have been at the top. But she still got all the gifts and toys she wanted as a child, even when money was tight. I think Nancy thought that the tantrums would cost her more in the long run. High on Lily's wish list that year was a Walkman. As soon as she had unwrapped it, Lily listened to it everywhere, even when she was eating or roller skating or watching TV, which made little sense to me. And she was always singing along to something, normally very badly. The song I most remember her murdering that year was Physical by Olivia Newton-John. "I'm bored of filming this now," says 12-year-old Rose from behind the camera. "One more lap! I'm getting faster every time," says Lily, whooshing past the outside walls of Seaglass on a newer, bigger pair of roller skates. "The slush puppies are nearly ready," I hear 7-year-old me say, and it's a shock when the camera turns in my direction. We're in the garden that my mother loved so much, and it looks freezing cold. I'm wearing a fluffy bobble hat and one of Lily's hand-me-down coats. I remember the wooden toggles that I found inexplicably difficult to fasten. I'd had 2 operations on my heart that year, and I do not look well. I'm far too skinny, and there are dark circles beneath my eyes. but I do look happy, playing with my Mr. Frosty toy and making syrupy crushed ice drinks for the Care Bears my sisters were too old to play with. The bears had been gifts from Nana. Mine was pink with a rainbow on its tummy, Lily's was blue with a rain cloud, and Rose's bear was turquoise with a shooting star. She was obsessed with the solar system that year.
"Stick out your tongue," says Rose from behind the camera, and when I do, it is stained red from slush puppy syrup.
The camera turns a little further, and I see Connor. He's sitting at Nana's ramshackle old garden table, wearing two jumpers, a paper cracker hat, and a frown. He appears to be deep in concentration while writing something.
"Hey, Connor, what are you doing? Working on another article for the school newspaper?" asks Rose.
"No," says the lanky but handsome boy.
"What is it then?"
"It's the darker family tree. I'm making it for your Nana, to say thank you for having me." I don't remember him being with us that Christmas, but I suppose he often was at Seaglass whenever his dad wasn't well enough to look after him. I do remember the family tree, though. It inspired Nana to paint her own version of it on the wall next to the staircase, with all our hand-painted faces and dates of birth. The shot seems to linger on Connor's face for a long time.
"Who is that?"
Lily says, skating past the camera again, which turns 180 degrees to reveal the sandy causeway. The tide was out, and Nancy came to stand beside us. We all stopped and stared at the silhouette of a dad-shaped figure in the distance. I looked up at Nancy's face, and the strained smile stretched across it confirmed that it was him. I dropped my slush puppy, Lily pulled off her roller skates, and I think Nancy must have taken the camera from Rose, because the next thing I see is the three of us running towards our father, who we hadn't seen for 6 months. He was dressed as Father Christmas, but barefoot, with his red trousers rolled up to his knees to avoid getting the costume covered in seawater and sand. We ran across the causeway to greet him, as though he were a brave knight returning from battle, which I know must have hurt my mother at the time. She was the one who stuck around to take care of us when he took off. Sort of, when my sisters weren't at school or we weren't all dumped on Nana. But we were just children, and didn't understand the politics of parenthood when people got divorced. Nancy waited where she was on the stone steps that lead up to the house, filming the moment. When my dad went to kiss her on the lips, she turned her head so that he kissed her cheek instead. One of the best things about Dad coming back from touring around the world with his orchestra were the guilt-induced gifts he brought with him. Don't get me wrong, we were very happy to see the man, but we were also eager to see what he had bought us. My sisters and I followed him inside and stood in the doorway of the music room, watching Dad as he opened his giant suitcase instead of unpacking in the bedroom he used to share with our mother. Lily was never backward in coming forward and blurted out the question we were all wondering about the most.
"Did you bring us presents?"
"Maybe,"
Dad said, and we cheered. When my mother said maybe, it meant no. But when my father said maybe, it meant yes. One word, two meanings. We might have only been children, but we were more aware than anyone that our parents spoke different languages. Lily's smile slid right off her face when she opened her gift, tearing the wrapping paper without even bothering to read the neatly written tag.
"I've already got a Walkman. I unwrapped one this morning," she whined.
Our father looked genuinely sad.
"Oh, I'm sorry, Princess. Mummy said that was what you wanted this year."
"The real Father Christmas bought it for her," said seven-year-old me. "There is no real Father Christmas. Why are you such a baby?" snapped my sister, glaring at me as though it were my fault that she received the same gift twice.
I knew she was telling the truth about Santa. And suddenly my whole world, not just Christmas, felt like a lie. I started to cry. Lily, that's enough. I mentioned the Walkman to your father a few weeks ago, but he forgot to tell me and Father Christmas that he was going to get you one. Don't worry, darling. I'm sure we can change it for something else. Why don't we do this properly? Connor, can you take the camera for me? We don't all need to be huddled in the doorway. Girls, give your dad some space and we'll open the rest in the lounge. Lily folded her arms and went into full sulk mode as my dad gathered up all of the presents. I got you another gift, Lily, just a small one, he said, trying to redeem himself. We shuffled into the other room, all with one eye on the gifts my father was carrying, while my mother wrestled us out of our hats and coats. For God's sake, Frank, we said one present each. Nancy's words sounded like they got stuck behind her teeth. Her gifts were like her love for us, and always came with a sense of economy. We sat impatiently in our family seats in the lounge. I sat closest to the Christmas tree in the fireplace, and instantly went from being too cold to too hot, so I took off my jumper. I was wearing a red woolen V-neck dress underneath, covered in white lace snowflakes. It was a gift from Nana, and I wanted to wear it every day. I know we said one present each, but I couldn't resist. I found this in a little shop in Vienna and thought of you, Dad said, giving Lily a small pink parcel. Good to know they weren't all last-minute duty-free purchases from the airport, mumbled my mother beneath her breath. She tutted for good measure. Lily ripped off the paper and beamed when she found a tiara inside. It was covered in fake jewels. Because I'm a princess, she said. Yes, you are, said Nana, walking into the lounge wearing a pink and purple apron and speaking in an ironic tone I was too young to appreciate at the time. She gave Lily a withering look before putting a tray of warm mince pies on the table. Nana, always preferring to do things her own way, made savoury mince pies at Christmas. They contained minced beef, onions, and a secret splash of Tabasco, and were served with tiny jugs of gravy. Lily pouted. Why can't we have normal mince pies? Because normal is boring, Nana replied. Then she hugged her son, my father, and sat down next to Nancy. I think she always wished that our parents would get back together just as much as we did, forever orchestrating family reunions that she hoped might actually reunite us. The camera turns to Rose and zooms in on her face. She was holding a box wrapped in tissue paper that was turquoise, her favourite colour. Unlike Lily, she opened her gift slowly, without tearing the paper at all, while we waited to see what was inside. Wow! Thank you, Dad, she said, holding up a telescope. You're very welcome, and just in case the stars don't always shine for you. Rose opened a second gift, and I remember what it was before seeing it on the TV screen. A box of glow-in-the-dark stars. Thank you, she said again, giving him a huge hug. It made me realise that Lily never thanked him once. I want stars, Lily whined, folding her arms. Dad ignored her. And this gift is for Daisy, my little pipsqueak, he said, passing me a box. Inside, there were five new books. They were all beautiful hardbacks, and I couldn't wait to start reading them. It's always important to have adventures, even if only in your imagination. Sometimes those are the best adventures of all, he said, sounding more like Nana than himself. Then he gave me a second gift, and I didn't understand what it was when I first saw it. It's a Viewmaster, explained my father, leaving me none the wiser as I stared at what looked like a red plastic pair of binoculars. I know it must make you sad that your sisters get to go away to school and I get to travel with my orchestra and you have to stay behind. But now you can look inside this and pretend to be anywhere.
Dad put a strange-looking reel inside the contraption, then held it up to my face. I remember being scared at first, but then I saw a picture of a forest, so real I thought I might be able to touch it. He showed me how to click the side of the gadget. The reel moved, and I saw a picture of a waterfall. It was like magic. I laughed, and my dad grinned, but his smile faded a little when he noticed the pink scar down the middle of my chest. I watched his reaction as he remembered that I was broken and felt guilty that it made him so sad.
"I've missed you all so much," he said.
His words were like a hug, and I wanted to believe them. The camera catches him looking at my mother, and her looking away. I was too young to understand any of what was going on between them back then. When you hold on too tight to something, it can start to hurt.
"Connor, I was hoping you would be here,"
Dad said, holding out a small gift.
"Let me take the camcorder while you open it. I hope you like it."
The camera turns to reveal a ridiculously happy-looking Connor, as though he had never been given a Christmas present before. And it made me wonder if maybe he hadn't. Nana said there were people who didn't believe in Christmas or celebrate it, and just the idea of that made me feel sad. "Different people believe in different things," she said, when I didn't understand. "What do you believe in?" I asked. Nana smiled.
"I believe in kindness and hard work."
"What about God?" She smiled again.
"I believe that God believes in hard work too."
"What should I believe in?" I asked.
"You should only believe in what you want to believe, and you should always believe in yourself."
It was a good piece of advice that I've never forgotten. Connor carefully unwrapped a yo-yo, unlike any I'd seen before.
"I found this in Shanghai when I was performing there," Dad said,
and my mother rolled her eyes.
"I'm told they're the best yo-yos in the world, but you're the expert."
"It's perfect. Amazing, thank you," said Connor, with actual tears in his eyes, as though our father had given him a yo-yo made of gold.
"And I'm told you've been writing for the school newspaper. I thought this might come in handy if you don't have a photographer,"
Dad said, giving him another slightly bigger parcel. It was a Polaroid camera, and Connor's face lit up like the Christmas tree he was sitting next to. I remember him taking pictures of us all for his darker family tree that afternoon. He took more of Rose than of anyone else. Nana used those pictures to paint our faces on the wall at Seaglass a few weeks later, so that who we were that day was captured in time forever. Dad's gift for Nana was a cuckoo clock from Germany. It's one of the most eccentric clocks in the hall. Every hour on the hour, a little wooden man and a little wooden woman come out of two tiny doors and meet in the middle before she chops off his head with an axe. They do this all day, every day. My father's gift for his ex-wife was less disturbing. He gave my mother a small red velvet box, and Nancy smiled her real smile when she opened it. We all admired the beautiful silver heart-shaped locket. There was room for two tiny pictures. And when my mother smiled at my sisters, I was sure it was their faces she wanted to keep inside. Memories are shapeshifters, especially the childhood variety. But that was a good Christmas. I don't think any of us appreciated our parents spending it together for us, despite being recently divorced. Looking back, I think they might have done more to make life better for us than we sometimes remember. My collection of happy childhood memories is a little threadbare. We make moments with our families.
Sometimes we stitch them together over time to make more of them than they were. We share them and hold on to them together as if they were treasure, even when they start to rust. Sometimes those moments change shape in our memories. Sometimes we stop being able to see them how they really were. Sometimes we have different recollections of the same moments, as though they were never really shared at all. I remember the food we ate, the games we played, and the music we listened to. I remember John Lennon singing about Christmas on the radio, and my mother saying how sad she still was that he was dead. I asked if he was a friend of hers. I was too young to understand people grieving for someone they'd never met. I remember me and my sisters singing along to I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day, and the whole family singing carols with Dad playing the piano. I overheard my parents briefly squabble in the kitchen, but not for long.
You can't buy their love, Nancy hissed, and Dad mumbled some inaudible reply.
Now that I'm older, I realise that the problem was that he could. He'd show up once or twice a year with gifts wrapped in shiny paper tied with pretty bows, and we treated him like a king. Meanwhile, we took her and Nana a bit for granted. There are things we should all know better, but being human means you can never know it all. Alcohol always seemed to help my parents to tolerate being in each other's company, so they drank more and more of it over the years, and the squabbles were replaced with quiet stares and the variety of silent conversations all parents have when their children are in earshot. That night, when my parents put me to bed, together but apart, and turned out the light, I saw a galaxy of luminous stars on my bedroom ceiling. Rose had used her precious glow-in-the-dark stickers to decorate my room instead of her own.
Night-night, Pipsqueak,
she whispered, standing in my doorway.
Why?
I whispered.
Because you deserve to see the stars just as much as the rest of us.